Okay, my clock says 9, so again, we're missing still a bunch of people, but we have to start, especially since, as always, I want to respond first to some comments or questions before we move in. This is the last two classes focusing on Ritzi Pesach Frank. But let me first, a number of you emailed me questions or comments, so let me begin with that. One of you wanted me to clarify what I quoted from the Chidah last class. In fact, if I'm not mistaken, Rabbi Avi Weiss issued yesterday to this woman that we spoke about, a Yola Yora, that is, she is permitted to rule on Jewish law, which really you don't need, if she knows halacha, she can rule. You don't need Rabbi Weiss to give her that, but they're not going to call her rabbi. But I mentioned that the Chidah, we saw with Fora Sassoon, that Rav Nissim said that she knew more Torah than since the Rabbanitz mentioned by the Chidah. So some of you wanted to know what that was about. Well, here's, we spoke about the Chidah, I'm not going to go through that again, but here's his book, The Shem HaGdolim, which deals with the great rabbis and the books they wrote. And if you look under Reish, or in the section dealing with Gedolim, he has a thing, Rabbanit. And when the Chidah says Rabbanit, he doesn't mean Rebbetzin. He means women rabbis. And he gives a, Manigai Hochatit Ruchanit Taranit. Okay, that's the title they gave her. Okay, she decides questions of Jewish law, she's a rabbi. When the Chidah refers to her as a Rabbanit, speaks of these women as Rabbanit, as I said, he doesn't mean Rebbetzin. He means female rabbi. And he quotes, someone that the Tashbates mentions, and the Sma mentions, and some others. Now you're going to say, well, how are these women rabbis, rabbanites? They were never ordained. Well, if you look in the Shema Gedolim, you can also find he lists another important person named Rabbi Moshe ben Maimon. And Moshe ben Maimon also was never, quote, ordained. Ordination is an Ashkenazic thing. Probably comes from the old practice in the, at least some people have speculated, in the Catholic Christian circles of getting a diploma. Whatever it is, it was created a big dispute because the idea of ordination is not part of traditional, there is an ordination, but this quasi-ordination that we have, where you're simply declaring that someone's learned, the Rambam never received that. I don't even know if the Chafetz Chaim never received that. So certainly these women were Torah scholars that the Chidah is speaking about. So like I said, if anyone wants a copy of this, I will send it to you. In all the discussion of women rabbis, I've never heard anyone, as far as I know, cite the Chidah. Again, as I said, speaks a rabbanit. So I think that's interesting. No, Fora was the mother of David. David Sassoon. Who's David Sassoon? I get confused between the two of them. Fora was the mother of Solomon Sassoon, who I believe was David Sassoon. It's easy to check. We checked last week in the Encyclopedia Judaica. The second question, someone wanted me to clarify a bit more about the dispute at the end, how Rav Avadia became chief rabbi. I summarized and said that the Dayanim turned against Rav Nissim because of the Langer dispute. It's actually more complicated than that, and as I said, you can look and get details in this book about Rav Avadia, but if you want to see Rav Avadia's own perspective, take a look in the Abiya Omer, Volume 9, Choshen Mishpat, Volume 9, and he discusses and describes how, in addition, Rav Nissim and Rav Unterman didn't get along, and he says that Rav Nissim really had the control over the Sephardic Dayanim, and they would never come to the chief rabbinate meetings, and therefore, what good is a chief rabbi if you're not getting along with the other chief rabbi? What's interesting, and you have to pay attention carefully, is that in his descriptions of the other rabbis, he refers to them all as Hagaon, this great sage. Now, you have to know how rabbinic titles work. That's a big title of respect. Even Rav Gorim is given the title Gaon. And yet, when he speaks about Rav Nissim, Gaon is missing. It's just Rabbi Nissim. And he quotes here a letter from Rabbi Yashiv, who was one of the Dayanim on Rav Unterman's side, which Rabbi Yashiv says, I urge you to, you could become chief, run for chief rabbinate, and remember we spoke about how it's maybe a problem, you're kicking out a rabbi, and he cites Rabbi Yashiv's letter telling him, go for it. One more couple more questions before we move on. One of you asked me about women reciting the Sheva Brachos, which apparently is, we are speaking a lot about what women do and don't do. So here is a sefer. I don't know if any of you are aware of it. It's published by this Institute Eretz Chemda in Jerusalem, which began about, I guess, 20 years ago or 15 years ago, that if you had a question, you'd fax it to them, and they would fax it back to you, the answer, and now you can email it to them. Now it's not such a big deal because you can reach all these rabbis via the Internet. But this is Volume 5, and all these answers were published with the approval of Rochelle Yisraeli, and then when he passed away, they all were given the approval of, and to this day, Rav Zalman Nechemia Goldberg and Rav Nachum Rabinovich. And in Volume 5, Number 113, they ask this question, can women do Sheva Brachos at a wedding? And they cite different opinions. They cite the opinion that they can't and the opinion that they can. The opinion that they can is in the name of Rav Yehuda Gershuni, who was a great scholar and the son-in-law of Eliezer Silver. He was regarded as an Eloi, but most people say have never heard of him. And then they conclude that in a Shas HaBchak, if the couple really wants to have the woman do it, it is permitted. And then they follow this with Rav Zalman Nechemia Goldberg's objection to this view, although they claim Rav Zalman Nechemia really agrees with the opinion, but it's hard to know what to make of it, because at first they say it's permitted to Shas HaBchak, and then they have Rav Zalman Nechemia saying he doesn't agree with it, so I think maybe his permission is only Shas HaBchak, or I don't know what to make of it. Certainly Rav Rabinovich would sign on to this also, so again, I can send anyone who's interested in that. Two more things. Oh yes, one of you asked me why it was with Rashar Yashav Cohen. We've spoken a number of times about him, the picture of him meeting the Pope last week. He was, 2 weeks ago, he was wearing a white kippah. So I think that's very strange to see a big rabbi wearing a white kippah, and I asked, and the answer was, in short, the Pope wears a white kippah, a white skull cap, so he does also. In other words, in the Catholic Church, the Pope, who's the highest person, he wears white, and the bishops wear a different color, and they move down. And therefore, it's not respectful for the rabbi to come in wearing anything less. You know, the Pope with his white kippah, therefore, the rabbi should also be on the same level. Two more things. You guys are cross, yeah, but I don't think we're going to have the rabbis start wearing crosses. One of you wanted me to clarify briefly about, I said that Rav Mordechai Eliyahu was in this quasi or proto-terrorist organization. Briefly, what the situation was, it was called Brit Kanaim. In 1950-51, you had these extremist yeshiva students. Shlomo Lawrence, the Aguda person, was also in it. And they wanted to create a state according to halakha. They destroyed cars that were driven on Shabbos. They burnt down butchers that were selling non-kosher. They had a whole plan to cut off the electricity and to set off these smoke bombs in the Knesset when they were discussing the issue of women being drafted. And some of them were even arrested with materials that were going to blow up the Misrat HaChinuch, the education ministry, as a way of stopping the secular type schools. Rav Mordechai Eliyahu was involved with this, and he was sentenced to jail and did time. He was a young man then. And finally, my father asks, so I'll end with this, what is my basis for arguing that Rav Avadia Yosef is the most important rabbi in several centuries? Actually, what I said is that he's the most important Sephardic rabbi since the days of the Shulchan Aruch, and the most important of all rabbis in several generations. So my father asks that Rabbi Soloveitchik reshaped Orthodoxy in America and ordained more rabbis than anyone in history. So my answer. First, I think we need to remember that Rabbi Soloveitchik is more popular now than he ever was during his lifetime. But taking that in, he's very popular as an intellectual figure, and intellectuals are interested in his writings. But how much he affects the average person, I don't know. Rav Avadia Yosef is the only rabbi in Israel that every Israeli recognizes. He influences every person's life, not just halakhically, but politically. He's one of the most important political figures in Israel. Look what I have here. One book on his life. A book on his halakhic rulings. There's another book that the author, his name is Chaim Shane, he regards two of the two most important people in Israel, Aharon Barak and Ovadia Yosef, each representing different perspectives. Here's another book about Rav Ovadia, his halachic methodology. Here's another one about Rav Ovadia. Here's a book all about Rav Ovadia's political movement, Shas party. He created an entire political movement. The whole idea of Sfardim, having pride in their ethnicity and all that, that's all because of Rav Ovadia. There have been numerous articles. There's doctoral dissertations. The man is still alive, and he's already been responsible for, what, 8 or 9 book-length treatments? And more and more are going to come, including numerous pure halakhic works that respond to him. This is an influence and a significance that the Rav Soloveitchik doesn't come near. Because, as I said, again, Rav Soloveitchik is mostly, he's not a leader for the masses. He's for the intellectuals, for the rabbis. Okay, we can come back to that later, but I see it's already 10 after, so I now want to move on to Ritzipes Frank, who's the last figure in this series. We should be able to finish him today and next class. If not, of course, we always have the next semester. But when we come to Ritzipes, we come to someone who, for close to 50 years, was regarded as an important posek. I mean, that in itself is significant. Many poskim, in fact, I think most poskim, only become significant towards the last 20 years, 25, 30 years of their lives. Rav Moshe Feinstein, who died in 1985, I don't think it's really until 1955 or so that we can consider him a great posek. He was still in the Soviet Union 50 years before his death. Ritzi Pesach, though, was different. And in fact, in the last 30 years of his life, it wasn't just that he was a great posek in Jerusalem, he was one of the great poskim in the entire world. In fact, he had and has a fairly unique position, and that I think he was the only posek in the land of Israel who was equally respected by the religious Zionist community and also by the Haredi world. That's very unusual. I'm not talking about the Terry Carter or anything like that. I'm talking about mainstream, what we would say mainstream Haredi. Rav Herzog, you didn't have that. You had it, as I recounted in my Rav Herzog talks, before the state was established, but once the state was established, didn't have it. Ritzi Pesach Frank was able to keep this loyalty in the free world until his death, so much so that in one of the Igah Haredi biographies, they have to invent a story that on his deathbed he repented for staying with the chief rabbinate. But he has a somewhat unique position in that respect, I think. Rav Moshe Zalman has that also, though. Rav Moshe Zalman was not a posek. But in terms of personalities, Rav Moshe Zalman had it. There's other personalities that had it. Rav Tukachinsky had it. But in terms of post-scheme, in terms of people who had to decide it, and we'll see both Rav Moshe Zalman and him. I don't know if it's 3DH. If you go into places like Ponevezh, then I don't know if they had the same view. But we'll get back to that. What you say, Jonathan, about the 3DH, I don't think as much. I think he's accepted now than he was during his lifetime. Today in our own time, you're right, Rav Shlomo Zalman. I'm talking about in the previous era, in the era of the state, when the state came into being, because we'll see that's when the great controversy came in. And I think what's different about Ritzi Pesach is that he really is part, and what I should have clarified this way I said before, unlike Rav Shlomo Zalman and Rav Shlomo Zalman, Ritzi Pesach is part of the machinery of the Zionist movement. So for him to still have the loyalty and the respect of those in that world, in the Haredi world, is doubly significant. And a part of this is due to certain choices he made, as we'll see. He made certain choices that broke with the Zionists. We'll get back to that in a few minutes. As we will see, he also was one of the few who was willing to take on the Chazon Ish, argue with him about important things, and his reputation remains intact. Unlike other figures, such as Rav Kook and Rav Herzog, whose reputation in the Haredi world has declined, Ritzi Pesach has remained where it was, and as I said, that's due to certain decisions he made. I mean, when you think about Rav Herzog, not just Rav Herzog, think about Rav Kook, it's hard for some people to imagine that in 1925, Rav Kook was the Rav for the Lithuanian yeshiva world. It is amazing that today, when Artscroll wants to see itself, wants to publish a biography, they publish from Rav Sonnenfeld, and yet all the great Lithuanian yeshivas in the land of Israel were on Rav Kook's side in this great dispute. This doesn't mean that they agreed with everything he said, but the old Lithuanian families, the yeshivas, I'm talking about the Italian yeshivas, all the great figures, the Rav Tukhachinsky, the Auerbach families, the Rav Yosha family, they were all on Rav Kook's side, and yet look how it's changed. Today, in B'nai Brak, they won't even mention his Rav Kook's writings in the Frankel Rambam, etc. Now look, I will say that with the ever-increasing extremism in the Haredi world, it's possible that even Ritzi Pesach will one day come to be regarded with suspicion by many of them. I think when we, you know, when we speak about things like that, we can no longer speak about the Haredi world removing figures from its path. I think it's really better to speak about the Haredi world removing itself from the mainstream Torah world and adopting the characteristics of a sect, which have been in growing evidence for a long time now. If you look at their newspapers, the way they refer to rabbis and others outside their grouping, and this is, you don't find this in the American Haredi literature, but you'll find this in the Haredi literature in Israel, and not just with regard to people like Rav Kook, with Rav Avadi Yosef, with Rav Shlomo Amar. So you really have characteristics of a sect. That's true, and that's the point I make in my book that I'm working on now on censorship, that his philosophy I don't make your point. His philosophy was well known. I mean, Oroth, the great controversy about Oroth happened in the 20s. What's different is that he didn't have a following of religious Zionists. Post-67, you have a whole movement of religious Zionism following him. So now that you have this great Rav Kook, who is the lodestar for a whole group of Gush Emunim and religious Zionists, that is what makes him puzzle, because he now becomes so identified, I believe, with a messianic type of Judaism. Before you had that type of Judaism, they could overlook these ideas of his. That's my theory, at least. Because the philosophy was known, not as well known. But the fact is, when the philosophy became used in practical terms, it's one thing to have a messianic philosophy, but when you have hundreds of thousands of people who are using this philosophy on the ground, then that puts him in a different category. That's my theory. Yes, well, of course, that will come. And just like the Shiurim came on Pesach in the 1950s, I think, or maybe the early 60s, Rav Simcha Elberg, the editor of Apardes, wrote about B'nai Brak. And basically he was arguing that from B'nai Brak to the world, that everything starts in B'nai Brak. Yeah, that's different. That's because he quoted letters from his father-in-law, the Aderis, who was critical of Rav Yitzchak Hanan and others. That's nothing to do with Rav Kook's Hashkafa. Rav Kook's Hashkafa goes back to Oroth and some of his other stuff. Now, it's very difficult to speak about with Ritzi Pesach Frank for the simple reason that he has many descendants. In fact, I see that there's at least one listening right now. So, when you speak about people without any descendants, you can say what you want, and people are not going to take it personally. I mean, when I spoke about Rosio, we had a grandchild on it. But when you speak about descendants, even if you think what you're saying is correct, it's not a question of so much of them correcting you about facts, which is possible, but a different perspective. Children and grandchildren also see things differently, but it's just a different perspective. Just to give you an example, there's a woman at Bar-Ilan named Miriam Karlbach, Miriam Gillis Karlbach. She is the daughter of Rabbi Joseph Karlbach, the rabbi of Altona, who was killed in Holocaust, Hamburg, Rabbi Hamburg. Her brother is Rabbi Shlomo Karlbach, not the singing rabbi, the former mashkiach of Chaim Berlin, who came out with a book on his father's life earlier this year, a very interesting book about, it's a fascinating book because it actually talks about, his father was a chaplain, I believe, the whole Torah Yom Derech Haaretz movement in Lithuania, which has been entirely forgotten. People don't realize that there was a whole movement of, what we can only say is Torah Umada, Torah Yom Derech Haaretz in Lithuania. It was centered in Kovno. And the Rav of Kovno, the Dvar Avraham of Avram Dov Ber Kama Shapiro, was the spiritual leader of this. This was an anti-Aguda, for the most part, type of movement. Anti-Aguda in the sense that they were in favor of secular studies and the like. I mentioned already that Telz had a gymnasium, Telz had a girls' school, etc. But so this Shlomo Carlebach, he's also the one I mentioned. We spoke about the dispute when he was thrown out of Chaim Berlin, and the current Rosh Yeshiva Chaim Berlin thought that he could ignore the Hazmana from Moshe Feinstein. So that's that family. Now this Miriam Carlebach sees it as her goal in life to memorialize her father. And she's published all sorts of stuff about her father, and when she wanted to get her PhD, she wanted to do a dissertation at Bar-Ilan on her father, and they told her that you can write things about your father, but you can't do a doctoral dissertation on your father. How can you do a dissertation on your father? You can't have any distance, any detachment, so she had to do it on something else. And she got the dissertation, and she returned to writing about her father. Professor Stamfer, who's written so much about the Lithuanian yeshiva world, and his book, the English translation of his book, Three Lithuanian Yeshivas, which will be a very big seller when it comes out. Littman Library is publishing it, my publisher, because everyone's interested in the yeshiva world, so different at the turn of the century. I mean, people say they can't imagine Bachrim who decide they don't like the shiurim of the Rosh Yeshiva, and they go on strike and things like that. He is a grandson of a great-grandson of Rav Pesach Frank, and there's many, many others. Mordechai Breuer, but even though Mordechai Breuer tries to be objective, even he wasn't so objective. He it was pointed out to him that he neglected to include a picture of the Rev of Frankfurt, the Gemeinde Rav, Mordechai Horowitz, in his book, A Modernity Within Tradition, and he acknowledged that just subconsciously he just couldn't do it because it was, it wasn't, Mordechai Horowitz was so much an enemy of the Breuer family. Okay, let's begin with the biographical details. I begin by saying there is no full-length biography of Rav Tzvi Pesach Frank. That is an intellectual biography. What we have, I'll show you what we have. We have this book called Hatzvi Yisrael, which is, it's a very thick book, as you can see, but it's mostly, says Chikrei Halacha, he wrote its halachic articles and letters, and also there is a biography here, although I don't call it a hagiography, but it's quite a long biography, over 100 pages. In fact, it's more than 100 pages. It's looking at it now, it's 207 pages. So the you get the biography here, although it's not what we would call an academic or a critical biography, but the details are there. In addition, we have this book, Tov Chesed Yerdefuni by Avraham Frank, Rav Tzvi Pesach Frank's only remaining son, the son who's still alive, who it's a story of his life and his siblings, but of course there's a great deal in there about his father. One of the grandsons, Rav Tzvi Pesach, brought this back to me, so I thank him. In addition, I got a lot of material from this book. Esa Einai El HaHarim, a big, thick book like this. This entire book contains one thing. The letters that Rav Tzvi Pesach wrote to his son, Yehuda Leib, when Yehuda Leib was in the land of Israel, studying at the Tel Yeshiva. Now, the book is really double in size, because if you look at each page, on each page it has both the actual text and the handwritten letter. So this book could be half the size. I'm not sure why he felt it was important to include the handwritten letters as well. Maybe because today everyone's afraid that people censor things. He's trying to show you that everything is here. But there are many, many letters here. And in the back there's beautiful pictures and the like. It's not just, I'm looking at it now, most of the letters are when he was in Tells, but you have some after he returned to the land of Israel, etc. This book, you can't get it in America. I've never seen it. I got it from Israel. If you're interested, by the way, in pictures, I saw that a few months ago. Some guy put up a website. It's some anniversary of, maybe it's the anniversary of your site. He put up a new website with lots of never-before-seen pictures, some very interesting pictures from his house and the like. I can send anyone the link to that site. Rav Tzvi Pesach was born in Kovno, 1873, known today as Kaunas. Now, the Frank family is a very well-known family. In fact, Rav Tzvi Pesach was one of 11 brothers and one sister. Most them actually went to America, which I think is interesting. Among those who married into the family, because he had many famous people married into it, were one of Recep Pesach's uncles had a group of daughters, and listen to these sons-in-law. As we know, it's always people in those days wanted great scholars as their sons-in-law. I think some people still might want it, but others, I'm sure, are happier to have a lawyer or a doctor. Rav Moshe Mordechai Epstein married one of them, and this becomes important that they're now part of Recep Pesach's family, as we'll see. Rosh Hashiva Slovakia, later Rosh Hashiva in Hebron in Israel, when Slovakia goes on Aliyah. The other was Rav Isser Zalman Meltzer, who we mentioned before, great Rosh Hashiva in Slutsk, father-in-law of Avraham Cutler, then comes to the land of Israel to take over the Yetz Chaim Yeshiva. I'm not going to repeat what we said originally, because we'll get to it in a little while. Why is it that all the great scholars in the land of Israel, I'll go over it one more time, have to come from Chutz La'aretz? Rosh Zalman, why couldn't they find someone in the land of Israel? Recep Pesach Frank and the like. We'll get back to that in a few minutes. And the third one, not so well known, but if you know a bit about American Torah history, you probably have heard of him. His name is Rav Shechtel Kramer. And since this show originates out of Toronto, I'll mention that he was in Toronto, actually. He was involved, he was the father-in-law, first of all, of Rav Ruderman. Rav Ruderman was the Rosh Hashiva of Neir Yisrael for, 50 years. His father-in-law was Rav Shechtel Kramer. And before they came to Baltimore, they were in Toronto for a time, if I'm not mistaken. Maybe I'm wrong, maybe it was Cleveland, but maybe someone can confirm it. I believe it was Toronto. Now, Rav Shechtel Kramer also had another significant role, as far as I'm concerned, in that he had a relationship with Rav Chia Yaakov Weinberg at the Slobodka Yeshiva. The way the Slobodka Yeshiva worked was that an elder bacher, would become a mentor, that's the best word, to the younger students. In fact, Rav Yehuda Yaakov Weinberg was a mentor for a short time to Rav Aaron Cutler. Well, Rav Shechtel Kramer was a mentor to Rav Yehuda Yaakov Weinberg. Now, why is this important? Well, because Rav Yehuda Yaakov Weinberg sent letters to Shechtel Kramer. And in the book I published, Volume 1 of History of Rav Yehuda Yaakov Weinberg, I include three letters, I believe, maybe two, to Shechtel Kramer. The problem from my perspective was that there are two more letters there. Now, this is in the family, the Neuberger family, who are the descendants in Baltimore. Two of these letters. In one of the letters, they told me they asked a shaila, and they were told not to give them to me. Why not? These letters contain Rabbi Chiyak of Weinberg, what they described to me, without getting into details. Those who've read my biography know that he went through a crisis in which he thought of leaving the yeshiva world, going to Haskalah. So who do you turn to in such a crisis? Turn to Rav Shechtel Kramer, who was his friend, the older bacher. And they told me that to let me see these letters would be voyeurism. I assume that in these letters, the three-day age bears his soul, all his problems, how he wants to leave. And they wouldn't tell me what's in it, but I just asked him, can you confirm that he talks about how he's, what direction to take in life? With one of the letters, they described some parts. They read out some parts to me. They won't let me see it. The other letter, they won't let me see any of it. When my book was published, when I could no longer write about this, or I said I would no longer write about it, I asked them, could I just come down to Baltimore? I drive down one day just to read the letters and then go home. The whole thing would take me 5 minutes. And once again, they got back to me. They said they'll think about it, and they told me no. So there are... For the biographer of Yehuda Yaakov Weinberg to know that in Baltimore, in someone's house right now, there are two letters in which describe this spiritual crisis of the person I was writing about, and the fact that I can't see it, what can I say? It's very troubling to me. But I keep up hope, you know, in another generation, maybe they'll change their mind. Getting back to the Frank family, so we see it had its share of Torah greats. Recep Pesach was typical of a future gadol, typical youth. You've all heard the story a million times, just change the names. It's all the same story. He's a genius. The Malamdin can't teach him. They say you can't keep him here. You have to send him to one of the great yeshivas. So at age 12, he's sent to the Slobodka Yeshiva, where he's only there a short time. after which he's sent to the Tel Zeshiva, which is why, incidentally, his son goes to the Tel Zeshiva, because that's where he went. He was not in yeshiva very long. He went to yeshiva when he was 12, and when he was about 15, he returns to Kovno. Why does he return? His father was being sent by the community of Kovno to the land of Israel to buy land. There was Kovno was a center of Chovei Tzion, of lovers of Zion, people who wanted, you know, the whole Sefer Kalasher movement that we spoke about. This is pre-political Zionism, people who believed in going back and settling the land. And his father was very involved, and they chose him to go to the land of Israel. In those days, when you went to the land of Israel, and you had to scout it out and find land, and then you had to see whether there was anyone owned this land, because a lot of this land had absentee people, there were absentee landlords in Syria or in Constantinople, and then you had to try to buy the land, and then you had to bribe various officials. This was a very, very long process. So he was going to be gone for a long time. Ratzi Pesach had to come home and be the man of the family. So he comes back to Kovno, and he continues learning in one of the Batei Midrash in Kovno. And before the great yeshivas were established, and this is how people studied, and this is still how many people studied. The Chazon Ish never went to yeshiva. You sat and you studied in the Beis Midrash. And sometimes you'd go hear shiurim if there was a great Torah scholar giving shiurim, or other times you just studied with a chavrusa, studied on your own. And that's what Ratzi Pesach did. He was actually able to establish a relationship with Rav Yitzchak Elchanan Spector, who was the preeminent posek. I'm not going to say he's regarded as the greatest Torah scholar in Eastern Europe. Some people might say that's Rav Chaim Soloveitchik or the Netziv or others, but no one would dispute that in the late 19th century, he is the greatest posek, greatest halakhicizer. The buck stopped with him. The most difficult problems were sent to Rav Yitzchak Elchanan Spector. Well, the Ravitshover would dispute it, because the Ravitshover would say it about himself. But I tell you that there were people who, the Ma'amel Igro, thought that he was greater than Moshe Feinstein. You always have these people who think that they're the Gadol Hador, and they're the Posek Hador. But I don't know of anyone else other than Ravitshover who regarded him as, he had a greater head than the Rav Yitzchak Elchanan. I'm sure everyone would acknowledge that, because no one had a greater head than the Ravitshover, but that his opinion on halakha was taken more seriously, never heard of it. I don't get the Mitzvah Yadas, what you're referring to, the Netziv? Yeah, well, they had what we call Megillos. For those who don't know, just briefly, when the Europeaners decided to break away from the chief rabbi in London and establish their own shlita and all, Rav Yitzchak Elchanan Spector ossered it. Now, normally, when Rav Yitzchak Elchanan does something, you listen, but in that case, they didn't agree, and they went to other rabbanim. But look, this is the way it always is, Chaim. You respect someone as the God of Adar, but if he gives a decision you don't like, is this the first time that people like that say, and by the way, they still keep their respect. They didn't say Rav Yitzchak Elchanan is not the God of Adar. They simply say, like they say today, they said that he had been given false information. He wasn't aware of the circumstances. So we're really not disputing his opinion. If he knew what was going on, he would agree. It's like today, people say when they want to disagree with Rav Yashov, they hold up Rav Yashov as the Posek Hador. He's the greatest man. You have to listen to him. All these are Buddhists in America, the Jewish Observer. And then Rav Yashov comes out and says that women can't wear shadels, or he says something else. What do they say? Well, it's not really him. It's the Askanim. It's the people around him. When he bans the music concerts, they always say, it's not him, it's not him. Now, maybe they're right. Maybe it isn't him. But the fact is that that's just the way that you can still proclaim someone as the greatest rabbi and yet say that you don't want to follow him. The people in London never said that these other rabbis are greater than Rav Yitzchak Elchanan. They simply said that he's unaware of the facts. And that, we have the stories even that Ratzi Pesach, in this relationship with Yitzchak Elchanan, they would take walks together Shabbos afternoon, long walks along the river. Why is that? It wasn't, well, Rabbi Chanan would like to go on walks, I assume, but why along the river? Well, in those days, irreligiosity was just beginning, and people still had great respect for the rabbi. And one of the things people did to be Mechalel Shabbos is they'd go boating on Shabbos. That was a nice activity in the spring and summer. But they were still of an era that if they saw the Rav, remember, he's the Rav of Kovno, of all of Kovno. And I've said this numerous times, that when these rabbis were elected, you had modern people, you had Zionist types, you had Maskilim, they all were involved in the election. And when they saw the Rav walking down, they still were of the era where they'd be embarrassed to be Mechalel Shabbos. And I've mentioned it before, Rav Shlomo Zalman Auerbach, Paskin Lamaisa, that if someone, he could be a Mechalel Shabbos, he could drive on Shabbos, and yet if the rabbi was walking down the street, and this person saw the rabbi, and he was out mowing his lawn, and saw the rabbi from the distance, and was so embarrassed, he would run inside, that this person doesn't have the status of a Mechalel Shabbos for Hetzia, because for Hetzia means in front of everyone. Of course, today, we're dealing with people who are so ignorant most of the time that the rabbi walks down the street, he continue mowing his lawn and just waves to the rabbi. Because they don't assume, they assume, well, the rabbi does his thing and I do my thing, and they don't even feel embarrassed. But in Kovno, they still would feel embarrassed. So he would adopt the walk along the river to, so that people wouldn't be Mechalel Shabbos. Now, Ritzi Pesach's father was away for a year and a half. As I said, he had to find a good place to purchase land, and he eventually settled on a piece of territory which today is known as Hadera. It's not far from the water. If you look at a map, you'll see it's between Tel Aviv and Haifa. Now, if you look in the Encyclopedia Judaica, it says that it was founded by members of Chovei Tzion from Vilna, Kovno, and Riga who had bought the land. Now, this is me talking now. The Kovno representative was Yehuda Leib Frank, Ritzi Pesach's father. Now, he wanted then, as a great lover of Zion, Yehuda Leib wanted to take his entire family to the land of Israel. But it was a little difficult to get everything together, so in 1888, he sends Ritzi Pesach, by, together with one of Yehuda Leib's nephews, two teenagers, on their own to the land of Israel. Ritzi Pesach is only 15 years old now, maybe 60 by now, to the land of Israel. And yeah, you can read the whole story, you know, I have to take the boat to get there and everything, but people can grow up fast. You know, today we would never do anything like that. We don't even send kids to New York City on the bus by themselves at that age. But in those days, they'd send kids to America, they'd go, people from America would be sent to go to yeshiva at that age. I mean, it was a different environment. He makes his way to Jerusalem, where he continues learning in the Eitz Chaim Yeshiva. Eitz Chaim is one of the oldest yeshivas in Jerusalem. And Rav Shmuel Salant makes a shidduch for him with a girl from the Shapiro family. It's also a very important family, no relation to me. Ritzi Pesach would have 14 children, and how they turned out is really a reflection of life in the land of Israel during the period of the 20th century. He has children and descendants who are not religious, who were and are not religious. Those who are religious Zionists, modern Orthodox, those who are in the Haredi world, the entire gamut of what it meant to be a Jew in the land of Israel, pre-state and early years post-state, is found in his family. And by the way, not just his family. If you look at all the other great rabbis, you can pretty much say the same thing. One of the Rosh Yeshiva of the Hebron Yeshiva is a great-grandson. Three of his children died in their youth. This was a time before penicillin. Living in the old city of Jerusalem, which is where people lived then, it was cramped, it wasn't sanitary, it was very easy to catch diseases, so without antibiotics, it's very easy to see how this could happen. In this book, by the way, you have in the back, the appendix here, you have articles from some of the grandchildren. You have Rav David Cohen, he's Rosh Yeshiva of Hebron. There's two Hebrons here, so he's one of the Rosh Yeshiva. You have from Charles Stanford, and you have from others. Did it include the women poet? I don't know. Maybe the grandson who's on here. I assume it's the same family as Rav Avram Shapiro, the chief rabbi, who goes back eight generations in the land of Israel. But Rav Avram Shapiro, whenever he mentions Ritzi Pesach Frank, He never refers to him as a member of my family, so I don't know. And I don't know the woman poet you're referring to, so I wouldn't even begin to, I mean, there's a lot of Anita Shapiro, etc. Oh, so we hear from Dave Landau, who's the grandson, not a relative. At the turn of the 19th century, when Ratzit Pesach is in his late 20s, his reputation begins to grow. The chief rabbi of Jerusalem, the recognized Rav, well, I shouldn't say chief rabbi, the recognized Rav, there was no official position, the recognized Rav of Jerusalem for the Ashkenazim is Rav Shmuel Salant. I mentioned on a previous class, why is it? It's a very interesting question. Jews have been living in the land of Israel for hundreds of years, Ashkenazim, supported by the Chalukah system. All they did is study all day, they didn't work, and yet every time they needed a great Rav, they always have to look to the land of Israel, to the Europe. When the Eitz Chaim Yeshiva needs a Rosh Yeshiva, they have to go to Europe and find someone. When they need great rabbis to run the Ashkenazi community, they need a Rosh Shmuel Salant, to the Aderet. You know, so there's no homegrown greatness coming out, and people have wondered why. What you say, our great Balti Chaim Lander, is entirely correct. The Doris Rishonim asks him about this, and he says to him, no, it's not true. We have great scholars, but because of the poverty and all, they don't come to the fore, but I don't think so. And this gets Menachem Friedman, in his article on this topic, begins by quoting the Cook's letters there, and Friedman makes the case that the only way to have greatness is when you have a society that supports greatness, a society that establishes a system of masses and elites, and people who have something to strive for, because they know if they strive and achieve, they become part of the elite. What's the elite in Eastern Europe? Very few people go to yeshiva, but if you work hard and you're a scholar, you can become a greatness. You can become great and recognized. And it's a system of elites, and that encourages perfection and advancement. In Israel, in the land of Israel, you didn't have a system, because everyone just studied. There's no incentive. There's no way to develop a system like that. At least that's his theory. So Ratzit Pesach comes, and he's just another great scholar, comes from a diaspora, Rav Salant, recognizes his talents, and begins including him in the deliberations of his Beis Din. There's all sorts of halacha questions that would come up. In the early part of the 20th century, Ratzit Pesach is officially appointed to the Beis Din of Jerusalem. Now his son, in this book, says it happened in 1902 when he was 30 years old. But it has to have been a few years later, as we'll see. It couldn't have been in 1902. Now, there's a very interesting story that's related to this. He's asked by Rabbi Shmuel Salant to be on the Beis Din, and he told him that he's not ready. What do you mean he's not ready? Well, until then, his focus had been on theoretical Talmud learning, the Lithuanian model. You could be in the Subotka Yeshiva, let's say, and you could stay there 15 years, and yet you're not ready to be a Rav. All you've studied is the Ketzos, and various Tosafin, and an analytic approach, and all, but you're not doing proper halacha. Things got to be so bad that the Subotka Yeshiva, they opened up a special kollel, halacha l'maisa, where people would actually study practical halacha. You have to study the Prima Gadin, and all these sorts of things. Rav Kamenetsky studied in that. Lithuanian Rosh Yeshiva are not posting. I mean, you see this today, you saw that in years past. You had Rabboni who decide practical halacha. Today, it's different because the community Rabboni don't have any authority in the Lithuanian world. The Rosh Yeshiva rule everything. So you have Rabbi Yeshiva, so he's also a posting. But they've never focused on Psak. In fact, Rabbi Soloveitchik, unlike the Sephardic approach. If you look at Rabbi Yosef Yabi Omer in the introduction, he writes how the essence of Torah study is for practical purposes. Asuki shemata v'dehochasa. And if you open the Rambam has a letter in which he says the same thing. That the whole point of Talmud study is not these theoretical debates. It's to get to the practical halakhic decision. That's not the Lithuanian approach. And if you want to see the best portrayal of this, look in Rav Soloveitchik's Halakhic Man, in which he describes it as a coming down, as if you have to decide practical halacha, if you have to accept a rabbinic position and actually deal in the real world, it's sort of like if a professor of medicine has to then become a practitioner. That practitioners is not what it's about. The theoretical halacha is where you find true greatness. And we know that Rav Chaim Soloveitchik himself was so involved in the theoretical that he himself would never paskin, or almost never. He brought in a special love, a Dayan, a simple fellow Uyghur from the legend who was trained in Prekel HaKhah to be the Dayan. Mr. Simcha Zelig is the grandfather of this rabbi I mentioned a few times, Golevsky. And he was the Dayan until he was martyred in World War II. And when there was an Aguna question and the like, and Rav Simcha Zelig didn't want to decide, and they sent it to Rav Yitzchak Hanan Spector, asked Rav Yitzchak Hanan to send back the answer, a one-word answer, yes or no. And Rav Chaim said, you need a one-word answer, because if you give his, he said, I can rely on Rav Yitzchak Hanan. If Rav Yitzchak Hanan says the woman permitted, I can rely on him. But if he actually give me his reasoning, I'll look at it and I won't buy it, I won't accept it. And therefore, if I don't accept it, I can't accept his stock. But as long as I don't have the reason for his stock, I can accept it. Yes, that's the reason. That's what Zevin describes in Ishi Meshito. He's too innovative, and he had all sorts of strange ideas, which in theory are fine, but in practice, it wasn't so much when it came to his son, Rav Moshe, also Rav Elvo, and Rav Joseph B. Soloveitchik, you see that they even carried this innovation. They were more able, they were permitted themselves to involve themselves, I guess, in some practical halakhic decisions. Although they only intended it to be for their students. For example, we're coming up to Sphira soon. They have their whole thing about shaving during Sphira, that it has to fall into Yud Beis Chodesh, that all Avelos has to fall into certain categories. This goes back to Rav Moshe Soloveitchik. It has to be 12 months, or it has to be 30 days, and since Sphira is obviously 12 months, and you can shave during 12 months, there's no concept of not shaving during Sphira. The fact of the matter is that since medieval times, people didn't shave during Sphira, and there's no evidence that the minhagim never has to be established on this sort of halakhic basis. So they could be very innovative and even apply it to practical halakha, but originally this was only for their Talmudim. If you look in Nefesh HaRav of Rav Herschel Schachter, you find all sorts of interesting things. I mean, according to Rav Chaim Soloveitchik, we do not have to fast on any fast days, even Tisha B'Av technically, but certainly not any of the other ones, because we all have the status of people who are sick, cholish eimo sakana, and those people don't need to fast. And there's a story that the Rav Schachter reports of how someone came into Rav Elvo's house on Shivasa or Tammuz or something, and he's sitting down and eating. I mean, this is not something that you can publish or that you can tell people, because this is sort of like a theoretical halakhic perspective that even if the family follows this, this violates all halakhic procedure. Rav Chaim Soloveitchik thought that you cannot wear tzitzis on Shabbos in a place where there's no Erev, and they really don't accept Erev in, basically. So Rav Elvo Soloveitchik, can you imagine the Gadol Rav Elvo Soloveitchik will walk around on Shabbos without tzitzis on? The Shulchan Aruch disagrees. The Shulchan Aruch says this is regarded as a garment, so you're not carrying. So they have these psukim that were just the family psukim. But what happens today is that you have the Rav Machzor, and you have all these sorts of things, and every Tom, Dick, and Harry wants to follow these practices. And that's why I said in my Sforim blog post, with the Rav Machzor, if they just would have put these practices at the introduction, that's one thing. But every time you reach this point in the prayers, they have a footnote there telling you what the Rav did. And the Rav was very opposed to this. He didn't think that people should overturn their minhagim for his own minhagim. And the fact that you have this Machzor, which each time it appears, it tells you what the Rav did. You have all these people now who want to be like the Rav and are changing the minhagim that go back many, many years. Okay, returning to the Sipeper. Incidentally, I will tell you that this Machzor, the Rav's Machzor, for those who know, look in the introduction, the name of it. It's unfortunately the person who gave all the money for this Machzor. It's one of the scandals we've had in recent years, and the Machzor will forever be known for this scandal. But what can you do? So what is a Ratzi Pesach? Getting back to Ratzi Pesach, he needs to learn halakha. So he tells the Shmuel Salant that he wants to go into Golas, as it were, go away and just study practical halakha so he's able to be a Dayan. Because as I said, the practical halakha Pesach is a different skill entirely. Shulchan Aruch and Poskim. He decides to go to Jaffa. Why? Because when he first came to Israel, he had stayed for a little while in Jaffa with a family, and he knew this family, and he could stay there. So he's going to go to Jaffa. There are other places he could have gone. He could have gone where there was communities, in Tiberias, Tzfat, or Hebron. But he went to Yafo. Now, Rav Kook had come to Yafo in 1904. And it was here in Yafo that Rav Kook developed a great attachment with Rav Kook. This is why I said Rav Tzvi Pesach's son, who says that he was chosen as to be dying in 1902 and goes to Jaffa then, he tells the whole story that he went to Jaffa, and it's a famous story, and while there he develops his relationship with Rav Kook, but of course that's impossible, because if he had gone in 1902, Rav Kook wasn't yet in Jaffa. So that's why the story has to be 2 years later. Unless we say that he did go to Jaffa in 1902, but the story of him developing this relationship with Rav Kook was at subsequent trips to Jaffa. But I don't think that makes sense, because the whole story, as it's told in many sources, is that he was in Yafo for an extended period of time. And over that period of time, he became close to Rav Kook. And that only makes sense in 1904, when he was chosen for the Beis Din. In any event, he becomes close to Rav Kook when Rav Kook has just arrived in the land of Israel. This is before all the controversies, and they develop a very strong and close attachment. And it's because of this strong attachment that Rav Tzvi Pesach remains loyal, always keeping his loyalty to Rav Kook to the end, despite the enormous pressures brought down upon him, enormous pressures to break with Rav Kook. And incidentally, it's none other than Rav Tzvi Pesach who introduces Rav Chalap to Rav Kook. Rav Chalap, the story is, he comes to Yafo once. I'm sort of like vacation. Rav Chalap never left the land of Israel and hardly ever left Jerusalem, but he'd go occasionally to Jaffa, Yom Ha'Water. You know, it's more relaxing. He comes there, and he knew obviously Rav Tzvi Pesach from Jerusalem. Rav Tzvi Pesach takes him to Rav Kook, and immediately they have a bond. And Rav Chalap becomes, I guess you call him a Talmud Chaver, a student friend, but he becomes the greatest student of Rav Kook. Really, their souls were bound, perhaps even more than Rav Kook's own son, and becomes bound to him for the rest of Rav Kook's life. And Rav Tzvi Pesach introduced him to him. Rav Tzvi Pesach's allegiance to Rav Kook is first seen in 1919. Why? Well, in 1914, Rav Kook had gone to Germany to attend the Agudas Yisrael convention that was to take place in September in Frankfurt. While he had been invited there, he to leave the land of Israel for him was a terrible thing, but he thought it was important to go there. The things are changing in the land of Israel. He wanted to put forth his vision, and obviously he was invited because he was one of the Gedolei Yisrael. While there, war breaks out. He makes his way to Switzerland for a couple of years, and then to England, where he remains from 1916 to 1918. After the war, he can return in 1919, and he's invited by many people, led by Rav Tzvi Pesach Frank, in fact, it was Rav Tzvi Pesach's idea, to offer him the chief rabbinate of Jerusalem. All right, let me say, before he was talking about what happens then when he returns, that there were disputes prior to 1919, no question about it. And he was when Rav Kook was in Jaffa. The big disputes, as we'll see, happen once he returns to Jerusalem. But you have big disputes. You have the Shemitah issue, where Rav Kook supports the Heter Achira, takes on the Rizbaz. I've said it many times, I'll say it again, that people have this perception of Rav Kook as some sort of like modern or orthodox or liberal rabbi when nothing could be further from the truth. He was a complete ascetic, a Polish, who was even a very stringent person. Michal Meharai has an article showing that in case after case, he's more stringent than the Chazon Ish. However, in matters dealing with the land of Israel, he was lenient, and he thought that there were grounds to be lenient because it's important to build up the land of Israel. I mean, when I say he's a Polish and as an ascetic, I've told this story before, I'll say it again for people who haven't heard it. They used to give Rav Kook his salary, and poor people would come, and he had no conception of money. He would just give all the money he had. And then the Rebbetzin would come in, let's say, on Thursday afternoon to get the money to go buy Shabbos food, and he wouldn't have any money. So they began to pay the salary directly to his wife. I mean, another matter is he literally never spoke to women. I mean, we're talking about a very unusual person, and far removed from any sort of prototypical modern rabbi or German type of rabbi. And he had other disputes. He had the famous dispute about sesame oil. We're coming up to Pesach. and the whole question of Kitnios derivatives. And Cook made a point which has yet to be refuted and can't be refuted. He said that by definition, Kitnios cannot be more stringent than chametz. And we know that you can take a piece of wheat and eat it, and there's no problem if it hasn't come to contact with water. And therefore, there's absolutely no problem in taking, let's assume peanuts are chametz, or kitnios, which until recently they weren't, but let's take, or a string bean or something, which you can eat raw. If you can take a piece of wheat and eat it raw, you certainly can take a piece of kitnios and eat it raw. By definition, it can't be more strict. And then he disputed with the rabbis in Jerusalem about kitnios derivatives. So it's an old dispute, and it created a controversy. As far as I know, they didn't dispute him about what I just mentioned about the eating the dry stuff. The dispute was about the kitnios derivatives. Like I said, I've never seen anyone. If we have Talmidei Chachamim listening right now, if you know of anyone who's refuted this very simple and obvious point, that kitnios by definition has to be processed with water because it's the Zera is the, or the minhag is the development out of real chametz, let me know. I've never seen anything, anyone who's ever been able to explain why Rav Cook is wrong on this. But, okay, so he returns in 1919. Now, before he returns as chief rabbi, he still had the respect of even what today we would call the extremist population. Rav Sonnenfeld, who, as we'll see, is his great antagonist, he had no problem with him when Rav Cook was the rabbi in Jaffa. In fact, Rav Sonnenfeld always referred to Rav Cook as the Jaffa Rav. Why is that? Because he thought that that's where Rav Cook belonged. And that's where he was appointed to at first, because this was a new yeshuv, new people coming in. It wasn't the old-fashioned Jews, and Rav Cook could speak their language, and he would have a positive influence there. This is very similar to what you mentioned in my Rav Gorin talks, that when Rav Gorin was the chief rabbi of the IDF, the Haredim gave him a pass, because they saw that he was doing great stuff in the army, bringing kashrus and trying to make it religious, but when then he tried to move into the non-army position, and tried to move into the classic rabbinic positions, then they had a problem. In fact, Rav Sonnenfeld actually went. Rav Cook has this mission in 1913 that he organized to the non-religious kibbutzim. They went to a group of these non-religious kibbutzim. It's called the Tshuva Mission. They tried to, you know, speak to them about Shabbos and Kashrus and the like. And Rav Sonnenfeld joins Rav Cook and Rav Harlap on this mission. Back before the war. He comes back as chief rabbi of the city, as I mentioned, Ratzi Pesach was the one who suggested this, and you can read in this book, Letters to Rav Cook. You have all the letters from the great rabbinic figures, which was Avraham's father and others, Ratzi Pesach, of course, inviting Rav Cook back to Jerusalem as chief rabbi, welcoming him back, etc. And just a couple of years after that, he's chosen as chief rabbi of the entire land. This leads to the great conflict that will break out in Jerusalem. And the question is, what side will Tzvi Pesach be on? There were some people that thought, that didn't really know his strong connection to Rav Cook, that since he's part of the old Yishuv, and the old Yishuv, there was a strong segment against Rav Cook, push comes to shove, his loyalties will be to the old Yishuv, against Rav Cook. Although most of the old Yishuv, it needs to be said, was on Rav Cook's side. The Lithuanian elements. But there were some people who thought that. That's not what happens. Rav Cook accepts the chief rabbinate, Rav Tzvi Pesach with his beistin, writes to Rav Cook, welcoming him as chief rabbi of Jerusalem, and that's when the great dispute breaks out. Just two more minutes and I want to finish this. The Kanaim were vicious in their attacks against Rav Cook. Immediately, they set up their own beistin under the auspices of what is known as the Eda Haredit. Well, a little later it becomes known as the Eda Haredit, the pious group. They also have their own shlita, their own slaughters, because the chief rabbinate for them is Pasul, and they have to have their own shlita. As with Hirsch in Germany, they declare that no one can belong to the Vav HaRumi. Shortly after the mandate is established, you have all Jews are in this thing called the Vav HaRumi, which is all the Jews, religious and non-religious, and the extremist group withdraws from it. Says that we cannot be part of a group in which we have organizational ties with non-religious, with Zionists. The chief rabbinate, you know, was part of the general Jewish governmental body, which has people like Ben-Gurion and the like. These are heretics. Therefore, anyone who's involved with this, we don't regard them as a valid chief rabbinate. We don't regard their state as valid. This is the exact same thing that Hirsch was saying in Germany. We need separatism. Rafi Pesach, however, is with Rav Kook. He's on Rav Kook's basin. Rav Kook is not only chief rabbi of the land of Israel, he's also out basin of Jerusalem, and Rafi Pesach is on his basin. Now, if you look in the Encyclopedia Judaica entry on Rafi Pesach Frank, it says about the appointment of Rav Kook, quote, "In the violent controversy that resulted, fomented by the extreme religious section, which saw no halachic precedent for such an appointment, Frank brought proof to bear." It's a nice sentence, but I don't think there's any truth to this. The extremists had no problem with a chief rabbinate. They didn't argue that there's no halachic precedent for such an appointment. The problem was a chief rabbinate was Rav Kook, and a chief rabbinate which had the non-religious as part of it. And as far as I know, Rafi Pesach never brought any proof to bear that Rav Kook's appointment was halachically binding. What he did bring, what his halachic weight was brought in a different direction, not to defend Rav Kook as chief rabbi, but to shut the Eidah Haredi down. And that's what will begin next class. So Rafi Pesach begins a campaign to bring the Gedolim, especially Rav Chaim Ozer, Grzinski, to shut them down, to say that the separatists in Jerusalem have no rights, and there needs to be an Isser, a Psul on them. And we'll get back to that next class. In fact, we might even go a little bit longer next class because there's a lot to do still in the biography as well as his halakhic positions. But we'll end here now. If anyone has any questions or comments, stay on for another few minutes. At University of Toronto, what's UT? University of Toronto, tell me what UT is. I don't know of any dissertation of Rav Zion Sonnenfeld. Oh, but is there anything else? Okay. I don't know of any dissertation of Rav Sonnenfeld. Torah. Okay, that's a master's dissertation, so that's not a... some of these master's at Toros are quite good and are worthwhile, but some of the master's dissertations just repeat basic stuff. So there's certainly room there to be a dissertation. You can use the Aguda Archives. The Aguda Archives, because the Aguda at this time saw Rav Zonnenfeld as their leader, and they have a complete archive full of stuff. In fact, the book I'll speak on next class by Menachem Friedman, Chevrot HaDat, uses this a great deal. And if you just look in the looking in the index here and looking under Zonnenfeld, and you see there's a great, great deal. So he's certainly deserving, not just of a master's, but a dissertation. There are two books on him. There's the three-volume Marad Ari Yisrael put out by the Vieta Haridit, and then there's the book by his grandson, which is translated by Arsko. His grandson is no longer in that community. His grandson is a more mainstream type. The difference between the two books is that the grandson's book is very respectful to Rav Kook. The Yedach HaRedit book is the seizure of Kook and sort of like the anti, I don't want to say the Antichrist, we're speaking in Jewish circles here, what do you call it? The anti-something? I don't know what you would call it. Just go to the University of Scranton, the Sitra Achra. You know, they don't go that far. They actually call him Rav Kook with a resh. They talk about how terrible he is, but they're very careful always to have the resh in front of him. Just refer to him as, and they cite letters to him in terrible ways. But the other one, the one the Art Scroll translated, refers to him very, very respectfully. Yeah. Oh, so he's all things. Yeah, yeah. Oh, yeah, yeah. This, you didn't have the extremism in America that you had in the United States. So first of all, you didn't have any extremism in America until after World War II. There are no Hungarians in America until after World War II. So there's no extremism. Do you know that all the great rabbis in America before World War II, well, until the mid-30s, they were all Mizrahi. The Agudas Rabbanim and the like. I always find it strange when these people, the extreme right-wingers, you know, cite these proclamations from the Agudas Rabbanim in America. These were all Mizrahi people. Then in the mid-30s, Agudas start to come to America, but there was no Aguda chapter. So you didn't have any extremism. In Israel, you always had extremism. And yet all these people who had nothing to do, they just sit around taking chalukah money, and terrible, terrible extremism. And not just against Rav Kook, extremism against Rav Shmuel Salant, extremism against the Aderis. You had all sorts of crazies in Israel. And it was just like, you continue. Detroit, Karta, and the like, it's always been a problem in Israel. There have been rabbanim who didn't want to go to Israel, take up positions, dafka because of the extremists there, who made the people's life miserable. I mean, for all the extremists in America, have the people in America, the so-called extremists, ever tried to throw garbage on Rav Schechter's head or things like that? I mean, they physically tried to attack Rav Kook. They physically tried to attack Tzvi Pesach, Amram Blau, and the like. There was all sorts of crazies who did terrible things. There was fear that people might want to stab Rav Kook. I mean, stuff you wouldn't imagine. The British got involved. They had a whole thing where they tried Rav Kook and hung him in effigy. And then a group of these guys were put in jail. These were called the Tzirei Aguda. I mean, terrible, terrible things were going on in the land of Israel. The Brisker Rav was definitely an extremist, but of a different sort. With one exception, he was not involved in any of these protest rallies. No, he was an extremist ideologically, but he was very much against... I think it'd be the Sheru Ilmi, he was involved in the protest, but he was very much against these protests and the things. He said as follows about the Snatari cards and the like. He said it was a terrible thing what they were doing. You go out and you protest. He said, in Poland, would you ever dream of standing on the street and protesting against the government what they were doing? Would you ever dream of standing on the street protesting against the movie theater open on Friday night? He said, the fact that they're doing that in the land, in Israel shows that they feel some shaykhah, some connection to the state, that therefore they have the right to express themselves. And he says, you have to feel like the state of Israel is no different than Poland. It's just like any other Golis. And just like any other Golis, you wouldn't dare dream of going out and protesting because you'd act respectfully. If they blew the siren, you'd stand up, that sort of thing. The state of Israel is no different than any non-Jewish government, and you have to treat it like any non-Jewish government. You have no connection to it. You have to be a shtadlan, do all these things. And the fact that people would go protest and block the streets, would any Jew ever dream of blocking the streets in Poland? Of course not. But Rav thought that you have to be choshed that the Zionists would kill you also. Therefore, you have to act just like you were in Poland. So in that sense, he's a complete extremist. But he himself was not involved in all these protests and things like that. And I don't know. These people are just crazy. I don't know. In America, they won't stand for it. In Israel, they always stand for it. You know, these people throw rocks and everything. This is always... I don't know. You know, also, in America, you have to get certain secular education. Even in the Satmar, get some basic secular education. These people go to what the equivalent of madrasas. They've always had their own culture. And as long as they don't do, you know, burning down buildings and everything, the Israeli government lets them be. And... because they're so insignificant. So I don't know. But there's always been more extremism. You never had this extremism in Hungary either. I mean, people there had to make a living. They had to do all sorts of stuff. We will see a lot about the extremism next class. Look, the Sonnenfeld suffered from this extremism. We'll see next class, Rotzi Pesach, how he describes how the Sonnenfeld suffered from this extremism. Okay. So... we will continue next week. Look forward to it. Thank you all for your comments. Thank you, Ken.